Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, November 26, 2020. Sudan's former Prime Minister dies from COVID-19.
When you look at the Sudanese political history, you will see his contributions despite being a point of criticism for many. He's one of the critical minds in Sudan through his legacy in the Sudanese politics or in his political party.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Sudanese transitional government has declared 3 days of mourning as the country prepares to receive the body of the country's former prime minister and leader of the Umar Party, Sadiq al-Mahdi, who succumbed to COVID-19 early Thursday in the United Arab Emirates. Al-Mahdi was flown to Abu Dhabi 3 weeks after he tested positive for COVID-19 in Khartoum, along with 21 members of his family and party. The transitional government has ordered flags to fly at half-staff across the country and in Sudanese embassies around the world. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Flags across the country and in Sudanese embassies around the world are flying at a half-staff in honor of the late Sadiq al-Mahdi. The former Sudanese prime minister was airlifted to the United Arab Emirates early this month after he and 21 members of his family and the National Umma Party tested positive for COVID-19 in Khartoum. Al-Mahdi was treated at an Abu Dhabi hospital for nearly 3 weeks before he passed on. A statement issued by the Umma National Party in Omdurman says Al-Mahdi died early Thursday in Abu Dhabi at the age of 85. His body is expected to arrive in Khartoum Friday morning and will lay to rest in Al-Mahdi's cemetery in Omdurman. Many Sudanese citizens describe Al-Mahdi's death as a great loss for the country. Abdurazik Kass, a resident of Niala in South Darfur State, says it would be difficult to talk about Sudanese history without mentioning Al-Mahdi's contribution towards building a democratic Sudan.
When you look at the Sudanese political history, you will see his contributions despite being a point of criticism for many. He's one of the critical minds in Sudan through his legacy in the Sudanese politics or in his political party. But at the end, we ask God to forgive him.
Manal Awad Khojali, who heads the Sudanese National Women Union, describes Al-Mahdi as an icon of human rights and a staunch defender of women's rights in particular. She says he was also a great scholar.
He has a lot of contribution towards defending women's rights and other concerns. He wrote a lot of books on religion, politics, among others. He always thinks about the future.
Eastern Nile resident Najmuddin Al-Bisairi says he was shocked to hear of Al-Mahdi's death. He calls the former leader a true Sudanese hero.
Sadiq al-Mahdi will remain as an icon of leadership which left us in the time of need. He was a great political and religious scholar who had always stuck to his values, which the new generation is supposed to benefit from his vision.
Al-Mahdi was born on December 25, 1935, in Omdurman town, west of Khartoum. He is Sudan's last democratically elected prime minister, who was overthrown in the 1989 military coup, which brought Omar al-Bashir to power for 3 decades before he was toppled by the military in 2019. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
The Ethiopian military will begin the final phase of an offensive in the rebellious northern Tigray region. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said on Thursday, hours after an ultimatum for Tigray forces to surrender expired. The government gave the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF, 72 hours on Sunday to lay down their arms or face an assault on Mekele, the regional capital of 500,000 people. Rights group raised concerns for civilians caught up in the military operation, For more, VOA's Jason Patinkin spoke with William Davison, senior analyst for Ethiopia at the International Crisis Group.
Well, as you know, it's been a little bit hard to work out exactly what's going on the ground with the communications blackouts, lack of humanitarian media access, etc. So we're just relying on both sides' accounts. But what we do know, or what looks to be the case, is that there was serious fighting around sort of 70, 80 kilometers from Mekelle, the regional capital, yesterday. And so now it's a question, with the deadline expiring, the federal government is talking about an assault on Mekelle, obviously, to, you know, capture the Tigray leaders. So the question is, you know, when will that assault begin? And to what extent will Tigray's leaders try and defend Mekelle? They've not been in heavy urban fighting in other locations so far, but Mekelle is the regional government headquarters. So it looks likely that the Tigray's leaders will try and hold on to it. A civilian population of something like 500,000 people. So this obviously presents, you know, potential, you know, very serious battle in and around Mekelle that could cause potentially mass suffering.
Now, do the Tigray forces have the military capability to fight off what is essentially the full force of the Ethiopian army?
What we've seen so far is, you know, significant federal territorial gains broadly coming from the west towards the east. So that presumably shows that Tigray's forces cannot fight on every patch of the region. But we do know that they are relatively well-armed. They still have manpower, firepower. They still seem to have some fuel supplies, despite their supply lines being cut off. So the question is, to what extent will they be able to defend this smaller geographic area, not just in and around Mekelle, but that sort of larger area towards the east of the region? There seems to be the possibility that they will be able to put up a certain amount of resistance. And even if they can't, then there is the possibility of some sort of fairly concerted insurgency developing from the remnants of the Tigrayan forces, even if the federal government takes control of Mekelle and other major urban areas and territories.
And looking at the Ethiopian federal government, why aren't they willing to negotiate?
Problem here is that obviously the federal government has been very clear about its objectives, to capture a certain section of the Tigrayan leadership, restore the integrity of the armed forces. So there's really no incentive whatsoever for those Tigrayan leaders to hand themselves in. And that's why instead they are likely to keep fighting. And the big question there is really, what level of support do they have from the rest of the government and the security apparatus and the Tigrayan people at large? There seems to be at least some chance that there will be continued significant popular resistance to any imposed transitional government in Tigray. And then on the other side, the federal government has no interest, it says, in negotiating here, because it says that the crimes committed by the Tigrayan leadership, violations of the constitutional order in terms of this so-called illegal election, and then also the act which triggered the final act, which was the final trigger for the outbreak of conflict, which was the forceful Tigrayan takeover of sections of the federal military. The federal position is that this cannot go unpunished, that it will set a wrong precedent. It will incentivize other similar actions of rebellion. And that's why they are refusing any suggestion of a negotiated solution and rebuffing any offers of mediation in this conflict.
Now, there's a lot of international pressure to de-escalate the conflict. The African Union has sent envoys to Addis. The European Union's foreign minister called for de-escalation yesterday. Are these calls for mediation, for de-escalation, having an effect?
Well, first of all, they are absolutely the right thing to do, because this is at core a political dispute and needs to be resolved in that manner. And then we've talked about the potential devastation that could come. Unfortunately, as things stand, the federal government is set on trying to achieve its objectives via this military intervention. Until we see some significant shift, potentially, maybe the federal government has to acknowledge that there is no quick, clean victory here, and its resources are being sapped by this conflict. Maybe there is increasing domestic discontent and increasing international pressure. Well, maybe that will provide an opening for these offers of mediation. But unfortunately, at the moment, we are set to see this conflict continue as the federal government tries to achieve its objectives, and the Tigrayans are set to keep struggling.
That's William Davison, senior analyst for Ethiopia at the International Crisis Group. He spoke with VOA's Jason Patinkin. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed today ordered the nation's army to launch a final offensive against the Tigray's leaders in the regional capital Mekele after a deadline for their surrender expired. The Tigray's People's Liberation Front rejected the ultimatum and said its forces are resisting the Ethiopian troops. Abiy pledged that, quote, great care would be given to protect civilians and minimize damages to the city. A communications blockade in Tigray has made it difficult to verify the claims of either side. Abiy's government says its operation in Tigray is focused on just certain TPLF leaders. The TPLF, however, says it is a war on Tigray. More than 40,000 people have been displaced in the fighting, which began 3 weeks ago. Many of them have fled to neighboring Sudan. Jean Bashir Hajvi is a team leader for the aid agency Mercy Corps at a refugee camp clinic in Sudan, and he spoke to the Associated Press.
The daily intake of the patients is between 80 to 90, and prevalent diseases, the majority of the diseases we are seeing by number, the highest number is the diarrheal diseases, the second one is the chest infections, and the third one is the malaria. So even the pattern of the diseases show the level of the needs of this patient, the need and the wash services. The diarrheal diseases is the direct result of the poor hygiene. These people don't have access to the clean water and washing materials.
He says the number of patients is rising quickly. The camp now houses more than 8,000 people, although it was intended for 5,000.
Just to imagine if for everything, for everything, starting from your food, ending with your water drinking, ending just to go for the toilet facilities and washing your hand, for everything you depend from somebody else. This is really very dire situation. I can't stress much how difficult it is.
That was Javnasir Hajve with Mercy Corps, who is helping refugees from Tigray region. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, how are people living with HIV/AIDS surviving during the coronavirus pandemic? That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. Question today.
In which way are you most like your parents?
In my physical appearance, I'm most like my dad. I do not really look like my mom. She talks a lot, but I also don't like talking.
I look very much like my dad and I speak like him too. But as for my mother, I don't resemble her at all, but I love her anyway.
I'm like my dad when it comes to giving orders, like leading. And then when it comes to my mom, I'm like her when it comes to cooking, because she has good cooking skills.
Yeah, like my character. People say I'm like my parents when it comes to character. Like the way I behave, the way I socialize, it's just like the way my parents do.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA health correspondent Linor Mudu. During this pandemic, the World Health Organization and Africa Centers for Disease Control say if you have a fever, a cough, or have trouble breathing, you should stay home and contact a healthcare facility. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest health news.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Cameroon health authorities say since the COVID-19 outbreak, a majority of the country's 750,000 people living with HIV/AIDS have fled hospitals for fear of catching the virus. Health workers admit their worries are valid, but say not getting needed antiretrovirals puts the immunocompromised patients at higher risk. Ahead of World AIDS Day on December 1st, medics are searching communities to get the patients treated, as Muki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
At Yaoundé's Baptist Hospital Etugebe, about 300 people with AIDS listen to speakers and health workers talk about HIV. 19-year-old Nyako Cynthia Njite, who for 5 years has been living with AIDS, says it has been 9 months since they last held a meeting.
We that are positive, we have monthly meetings. We sit together, share ideas, encourage others, people share their success stories. And due to the fact that people cannot meet, it disturbs children from coming together and having the fun they always have. And also, when they come for drugs, we always have counseling session with them. They play with toys. Those things are not more happening.
More disturbingly, Cameroon's health ministry reports that of the 300,000 HIV-positive people in the country who need antiretrovirals, about 60% refuse to visit hospitals because of COVID-19. Sienten Gek is with the Cameroon Baptist Convention Health Services. He says failure to take antiretroviral drugs can weaken the immune systems of people with AIDS.
When the immune system is that weak, every disease that comes to the body is going to infect the body. So you have frequent diarrhea, weight loss, diseases like cryptococcal meningitis and tuberculosis. These are very common opportunistic infections.
Gilbert Tenney of the Cameroon Medical Council says to fill the gap, medics are going to AIDS patients in their homes and giving them a 1 month supply of antiretrovirals.
We need those patients at the hospital to keep on counseling, to provide them with drugs and provide them with any other support. That's why we've come out with what we are calling differentiated service delivery, which has made us to go out to the community in order to assist who cannot come to the hospital.
Health worker Awa Fani says some hospitals in Cameroon are running short of funds for AIDS patients because of the pandemic.
Funding has become limited. Funders are now paying more attention to COVID-19. And so we are asking ourselves, how can we ensure that we distribute resources in an even manner such that we still care for children who are HIV positive while taking care of those who are COVID-19 positive?
Even before the pandemic, Cameroon health officials struggled to get AIDS patients to hospitals for treatment. Cameroon's Minister of Health says in 2019, 75% of AIDS-infected children died in their first 5 years. The government blames parents who fail to follow up on treatment for their children, while many parents cannot afford transport fees to get them to city hospitals. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Journalists in Britain say they are facing an increasingly hostile environment with intimidation, physical assault, and online abuses now seen as routine and part of the job. For VOA News, Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Britain's National Union of Journalists surveyed its members on their experiences of intimidation and abuse. More than three quarters of respondents agreed that it has become normalised and seen as part of the job. Some 51% reported receiving abuse online, with women and ethnic minorities particularly targeted. Michelle Stanistreet is Secretary General of the National Union of Journalists.
If you're being threatened with rape, if you're being threatened with grotesque violence, if your family members, your children are being threatened over social media, you can't simply think, don't feed the trolls, don't engage with it. You have to take those threats very seriously. And even if you weren't, the very fact that this content is appearing in your life, in your home, is incredibly unsettling, and it's affecting people's mental health and their well-being.
One in five respondents said they had been physically attacked. Journalists in Northern Ireland reported increasing threats and assaults. the killing of 29-year-old Lyra McKee, who was shot dead as she reported on rioting in the city of Derry in 2019, underlined the ongoing dangers that journalists face in the region. Many respondents said that abuse and intimidation had worsened under the coronavirus pandemic, especially during public demonstrations and protests. Again, Michelle Stanistreet.
Having their camera equipment targeted and damaged, and in some instances being physically assaulted.
Many of those surveyed blamed politicians for stoking a hostile climate for media. Again, Michelle Stanistreet.
Some of the rhetoric we've seen targeting the work of journalists, dismissing stories that don't meet with their approval as fake news, attacking so-called campaigning newspapers. It's made the climate, I feel, very much, particularly challenging for people who are simply trying to do their jobs.
The British government says it is considering new legislation requiring social media companies to take responsibility for threatening and abusive material on their platforms. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Africa is bracing for a second wave of coronavirus, according to the continent's top medical officials. Meanwhile, experts and governments say they are happy with the news of three successful vaccine trials and hope to distribute the vaccine across the continent. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
As a second wave of coronavirus approaches, Africa has a plan, says the continent's top health official. In recent weeks, the continent has started to distribute 2.7 million rapid antigen tests. By mid-2021, health officials hope to vaccinate 60% of the continent's population with one of the several promising new vaccines. Now, says Dr. John Nkengasong, director of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, it's up to the continent's leaders to try to make that happen.
And that will also require that we mobilize up to about $10 to $12 billion, including the cost of buying the vaccines and the cost of delivering the vaccines there. So that is the 60% mark that we really want to achieve. And I just really want everyone on this platform and our partners to understand that as a continent, that is our aspiration and our goal.
Dr. Nkengasong added that experts are working to bring more clinical trials to the continent. But he stressed, as COVID-19 numbers rise in some countries, notably South Africa, Kenya, and Algeria, the continent's health facilities appear to be weathering the onslaught.
We are not seeing hospitals being overwhelmed with COVID patients. That is clearly what our situation is. We are very encouraged that during the first wave, we didn't see that kind of overwhelming, which we were very, very worried and concerned with. That doesn't tell us that the second wave, that scenario will not happen. It only tells us that we have to prepare for and prepare using the three T's, which is The test, the trace, and the treat.
As the continent approaches end-of-year holidays, he underscored one piece of advice.
Do not relent in wearing masks. One message that is emerging across the visits we are conducting across the continent is people are not masking enough. And in some settings, absolutely, it seems like they are not masking at all. And that is extremely dangerous. My worry and fear is that the sacrifices and gains that were made since the beginning of this year, those gains that were made in terms of bringing the pandemic down to where we were in October, may be completely wiped off if we relent at this point.
So there you have it, from the continent's top medical expert. Wear your mask, wash your hands, keep your distance, and stay safe. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A soccer legend, Diego Maradona, died Wednesday, less than a month after celebrating his 60th birthday. Although worshipped by many for his soccer talents, it was his personal demons that grabbed the headlines later in life. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports.
Diego Armando Maradona died after suffering a heart attack at his home in the suburbs of Buenos Aires. Those close to him confirmed on Wednesday. Maradona was so much to so many in Argentina and beyond. Slava Malamud is a sports analyst.
he is the very embodiment of that peculiarly Argentinian term, el pibe, the boy, the lad. He is that's how Argentinians, especially like the poor Argentinians, see themselves. You know, this ruffled haired, spunky, you know, devil may care type of individual, fun loving, who is just effortlessly brilliant. And that's why he was called El Pibe de Oro, the golden boy, is because he is just the most El Pibe person who was ever born. And I think this is how he's going to be remembered in Argentina.
Revered as one of the greatest soccer players of all time, Maradona led Argentina to win the 1986 World Cup. His two goals against England, one of which was controversial, secured an epic quarterfinal victory. Malamud remembers watching that match. Again, Slava Malamud.
Both goals were tremendous. Everybody saw it was a handball. Everybody except for the referee saw it was a handball. But I think now that even in England, people understand how brilliant the guy was.
From soccer clubs to famous players to ordinary people, tributes are pouring in on social media. Gracias por todo, Diego. Thanks for everything, Diego, writes FC Barcelona. Eternas gracias, eterno Diego. Eternal thanks, eternal Diego, writes his former team, Boca Juniors. Famous players like Ivorian Didier Drogba writes, my idol passed away. Rest in peace, Diego Armando Maradona. My first ever football shirt, the man behind my love for football. Another famous player, Kylian Mbappe, writes, RIP, legend, you'll stay in the history of football forever. Thank you for all the pleasures you gave to the whole world. About a month ago, Maradona celebrated his 60th birthday. A 100-meter-long billboard was erected in his honor at the center of Buenos Aires. Pablo Fernandez was a fan.
Many criticize his personal life. Diego is soccer. He is life. He is everything. With his private life, he can do whatever he wants. But he gave us everything. He is the greatest thing in the world. He is the greatest thing there is.
His life beyond soccer often drew fierce criticism. Again, Slava Malamud.
The things that happened to him later, you know, the drugs, the alcohol, the cozying up to dictators and unsavory characters worldwide. It was his failings as a human being that caught up with him later. When he was at his peak doing what he loved, he was able to mitigate those things. And he was able to show the world his actual talents. When he was forced to stop doing what he loved, all the bad things came out. I hope that's not what people remember about him.
As his fans at home and around the world mourn his passing, Argentine President Alberto Fernandez declared 3 days of national mourning. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
That's all we prepared for you this Thursday. We would like to welcome our listeners on 97.5 FM Radio Sawa in Khartoum. We now leave you with the song Kaya by Bob Marley. We've been listening to Bob Marley with the song Kaya. I'm John Tanz in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask when you're leaving your house. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.